All right, today is March 4th, 2015. This is the third interview with Thomas Archdeacon. We are here in his office inside the Humanities Building. My name is Troy Reeves. I'm with the UW-Madison Oral History
Okay, Thomas Archdeacon.
Perfect. I'm just going to get just a touch closer.
Okay.
All right, that'll be great. So my first question is kind of a series of questions based on, being a veteran. So military background has influence, if any, on the Madison campus. So the first question would be, relationships or friendships with other faculty who were veterans. Did you...
Not specifically. I mean, occasionally you would find out somebody was a veteran and there'd be kind of a mutual look of surprise, and that would be about it.
Okay.
I didn't join any veterans organizations or things like that. I figured that my time in the service was fairly productively spent, and insofar as people needed services and the like, there were probably people who needed them more than I did, so I've never been big on sort of pulling the veterans card.
Okay. Although you did list on our way out the first session, you told me of some names of some folks that you found out, faculty or staff who are veterans on campus.
Yeah, I just found out kind of
accidentally. I wonder if you wouldn't mind, it's not the most gripping oral history, but maybe just sort of listing some that you found out over time were veterans.
Yeah, Alan Bogue was in the Canadian Army during World War II. Jürgen Herps was in the German Army during World War II. David Lovejoy was in the American Army, 10th Infantry. He was a mountain troop during World War II. Those I remember. Then I know that sort of a generation younger than that group, Dick Sewell had been in the Navy probably in the 1950s or so. He was probably about 10 years older than I was, maybe 15. John Dower, who was closer to my age, but still older, maybe 5-7 years older. He, I believe, had spent some time in the Air Force. Among the current group, people who are still here, none of those people is either active or here. Bogue is retired. Lovejoy and Herbst have died. John Dower left. Dick Sewell has retired. I think Matt Kaufman, our military historian, had spent some time in the Army as well. Matt Kaufman had. I'm positive he did. Among our current group, there's John Hall, who was 15 years in the Army, but almost made like the Army a career before he came here. Mike Chamberlain, who teaches Middle Eastern history, spent some time in the Army before he went to... He might even spent it before he went to college. I'm not sure, either between college and graduate school or between high school and college. I'm not sure which, but he spent some time in the Army. I imagine those are the only people currently. But I can't really guarantee that.
Right.
You could get surprised, but I would be surprised if, in most cases...
Okay.
I mean, a lot of our recent hires have been women. Some of them have been, the men, all regardless of their sex, some of them have been from foreign countries, so I'd be even less likely to know what they were, if they performed any service commitment wherever they came from, and the like. I mean, not that women couldn't have performed a service commitment, but the career trajectory of a woman going from the military into academics would be very unusual at this point, and We did have a graduate student, a female graduate student, that spent time in the military and then went on. But in terms of our faculty women, I don't think I've encountered any stories about their having served, nor any of the other males that have been recently hired.
Okay, thank you. So how about when you found out that students you were teaching were vets? What sort of... Was there any sort of...
Well, there may have been an emotive connection. I mean, you know, sometimes you'd find out in the context of a problem that they were having. There was one guy who was having trouble getting his veterans benefits recognized for tuition, so I found out about that, and I tried to help him out a bit. And others you would just hear had served or whatever, and, you know, didn't really treat them any differently from the way in which I would treat another student, but I sort of took that into consideration when you're dealing with an individual student among the set of experience he or she might have had that, mm-hmm. you know, could be affecting how they saw things or whatever. I remember one time showing this was long ago, this would have been in the 1970s when I was teaching a course on the American Revolution, showing a film about the Battle of Culloden, which was a battle in Scotland. It's in the 1745 uprising, but it tied in with Scottish migration to North America. It tied in with the style of warfare in the 18th century and the like. And so I showed it, and there was a guy afterwards who came up and said that he had found the film disturbing because he was a veteran and it was too realistic. Mm. So, which I thought was an interesting comment. It didn't really stop me from showing it or whatever. And he wasn't really asking me to do it. It was just more one of those little exchanges. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's no really great stories about how it affected my interactions with students. Sometimes we'd have people come through here. The military would send people through here who were doing that couple of years of graduate training before they would go to a service academy to teach. And I would tend to get to know those students a little bit better maybe than some other graduate students. You know, there would be a... You know, they'd like to know what it was like to teach at West Point when mm-hmm. they were going there or whatever. You know, it was just wasn't tremendously substantive in terms of their education, but more just in terms of their adjustment here.
Okay. So you came here during the tail end of the Vietnam War.
Right, yeah.
So coming to this campus, I know that the protests weren't as big.
Yeah, no. I mean, once the draft ended, the protests pretty well ended as well. I mean, obviously there were protests, but not at all on the scale that there had been. Whether the extent to that which that was tied to the ending of the draft and the extent to which it was tied to however slowly it was happening, the policy was that we were disengaging. I mean, it was pretty evident that the engagement would not continue much, much longer. So some combination of those, you know, the mm-hmm. battlefield losses were lower, the number of troops present were lower, all the talk was of Vietnamization or American withdrawal. Some people might have thought, well, it was taking too long and the like. And there's a good argument that there were lots of people killed during this prolonged slowing down process. But it didn't have quite the, you know, the impact of the time when the war was ratcheting up, and especially with the draft too, mm-hmm. and people probably felt very vulnerable, you know, mm-hmm. at that point. And certainly one impetus would have been relieved by the end of the draft.
Okay. One other event that happened on the campus while you were here that has a military angle to it is the controversy around gays serving in the military. particularly in the late 80s, yeah, early 90s, there was protests on this campus about the ROTC.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you have any memories or any specific involvement in any of that.
No, not... I mean, I remember going to a faculty meeting one time on that. It was, I think it was a general faculty meeting where they were trying to get the feeling. I think the thing that I remember primarily was a question of driving ROTC off campus, and the faculty was not willing to do that, whatever they felt about the issue of gay marriage or not. I think more people were, I mean, some people obviously were, or not so much gay marriage, but just the presence of gays in the military. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, I mean, one step at a time, I suppose. I mean, some people undoubtedly were opposed to it, or whatever, society was divided at that time, but even among, I think there were, I didn't have a big problem with gays in the military, but the guy with whom I served, I found out subsequently was, you know, gay, you know, no big deal. But I would have opposed breaking the tie with the military, so that was my stance on it, and I think it was the stance of at least of the majority who voiced their opinion at these mm-hmm. meetings or straw ballots or whatever.
So you wanted to keep, you were keeping the ROTC on campus. That
right.
was what,
yeah, I mean,
that was what the issue, at least in your eyes,
yeah,
if there
that
was an
was
issue,
it.
That was the issue to you.
Well, that was the immediate issue. I mean, whether the solution to the issue of gays in the military was removing the ROTC from campus, I saw it as two issues, really, and that the removal would not affect the policy in particular, and indeed might reduce any voice the university would have, this university and similar universities might have in the process. And I mean, you had the usual political alignments on this. There were people who felt very sincerely about this issue and it was very important to them. They thought it was a civil rights issue on a par with the other civil rights issue of the era, and they, in much the same way they wanted to divest from South Africa or whatever, they wanted to divest from the military. To a certain extent, some people were sort of constantly against whatever position the U.S. government, especially the U.S. military, was taking at any time, and probably had it been an issue over how army mules were treated, they would have been for removing it. So there was a big spectrum. There were probably people who wanted to keep ROTC who were totally opposed to gays in the military. There were people who wanted to keep ROTC who were indifferent or who were in favor of keeping gays in the military or allowing gays in the military, but who didn't think getting rid of ROTC was the answer. And then on the other side, you had a similar spectrum of motivations and mm-hmm. political stances.
Okay. Thank you. And so we didn't get to talk about last time the path to tenure, so we're going to sort of look back.
Okay.
So I wonder if you could talk about the process of tenure.
Well, surprisingly enough, when I came here, I really didn't understand it. I mean, now we have very elaborate procedures about advising probationary faculty members of their rights and mentoring them and the like, and back then it was more a question of, boy, we hope you don't embarrass us. Better not screw up. Get your work done. It was, I mean, not that people were mean necessarily, but there wasn't really quite as much elaboration and paperwork around the process as there is now. I mean, they send up a dossier for tenure now, and my God, it's hundreds of pages at times. The understanding was, all right, you have to teach, you have to perform service, you need to show that you're a serious researcher. Ideally, the time to go up is after you have your first book published. I published my first book, I went up, and at the higher end, there was some back and forth about it. And I think that partly was because I went up maybe 2 years early. Mm-hmm. And that's something we would never do now. I mean, what happened is that we've had some very fine candidates turned back, not permanently, but just held, say, no, you're doing well, but we want to see some more from you, that kind of thing, which nobody takes in that spirit. They all take as an affront and as a suggesting that they're not worthy in some fashion. But now we sort of, going up to tenure is a very almost mechanized process of watching the person and building the record and counseling them on how it needs to be done. Back then it was a question, you better get your book published in time. And that was about it. You know, I mean, we say it's only it. You had to show good performance in other ways. You had to have promise continuing performance and the like. But that was the kind of thing. I mean, it still doesn't make sense to me, and I'm certainly not going to mention any names, but I have in recent memory seen cases where a committee would, somebody goes up a year early with a very distinguished record, and they would stop that person and say, well, you know, we don't want you going up this year. We want to see a little bit more. And somebody else would be coming up the same year with a much more marginal record, but it was their final year, and they'd let the person through. And so, I mean, the way it struck me was, here's a person who in, let's say, 4 or 5 years has accomplished more than this other person has in 6 years, and you're saying, no, we want to see more, with the person who's accomplished less, you're going to let through. There's a gap in the logic here. I just don't see it. And I feel fairly strongly about that, but I've certainly not been on the winning side of that argument, and I think our feeling in the department now is that it's unwise to put up somebody early because you, in effect, threaten to put them in you expose them to a potentially negative emotional experience, an alienating experience that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the quality of the case. Mm. So, it's just one of the odd ways in which this institution works, and I'm sure other institutions have equally quirky ways about them.
So what do you recall about the specific process of turning the dissertation into the book?
Well, basically, you got criticism on it. You know that you have to expand it, that it can't simply be the dissertation redone. That it, of course, any dissertation has a sort of dissertation quality to it, rather than it's aimed at more of a technical presentation than at a literary presentation. Not that the two are mutually exclusive, but that there is a shift in emphasis. And so you need to make sure that you can talk to a wider audience than the one that you were focusing your dissertation on. Presumably, they expect the subject of the dissertation to be expanded somewhat, I mean, within the same area, but looking at another set of years, or, you know, maybe giving more surrounding detail than you have. And that was primarily what mine was. I think to a certain extent, some of this problem comes up, and there are all kinds of tricks as to the nature of the divisional committees and who's on them and what disciplines they represent at the time. in a lot of disciplines, the dissertation is, I don't want to say tainted, it's not tainted, but it's seen as much as being the work of the mentor as it was the work of the student. And the question is, well, what can this student or former student produce now that he or she is out of the mentor's lab, for example? Whereas in a field like history, really, the dissertation is usually quite independent from the mentor, and the mentor will have, it depends on who's directing the dissertation and who the student is and the like, and how close the similarity of areas. But there's, I would say, probably in the majority of cases, the candidate is not a clone or a spin-off of the mentor. She or he is an independent scholar already, undoubtedly influenced by the thing. And the dissertation itself is a product of independent work rather than a product of heavily supervised work. And so some of that has to do, as people negotiate their way through, some of that has to be explained, I think, when people are going up to different divisions and the like. Because they're very interested. All of them are interested in seeing what the independent work is. And increasingly, I think this idea of turning the dissertation into a book, and that is, it seems now, although still very important, maybe where it was 80% before, now I'd say it's perhaps 55-60%. Without the book, you probably won't be viable. On the other hand, you better be showing more than the book, because there is this kind of discounting of the dissertation as work done before you got here. Okay? And
so I want to talk about students, and we sort of talked about students in terms of students and veterans, but now sort of specific students.
Yeah.
And it could be either undergraduate or graduate. So the first is sort of a general question about memorable students who stand out to you. And
oh,
they do.
Probably my most memorable student was Russ Feingold. Joel Grossman up in political science and I co-directed Russ's senior thesis, and I know that I wrote a letter for him for his Rhodes application. He was a Rhodes Scholar, and I'm sure Joel did too. He was at least as close to Joel as he was to me, probably closer. So he probably would be the most famous student that I've had, or at least famous in the sense of somebody who is whose name is, in terms of anyone who knows about American politics over the last 30 or so years, his name would be familiar. Mm-hmm. There are other students as well, but in a way I don't particularly want to he's easy to set apart because he was a major political figure in the state and, for that matter, in the nation. There are other very fine students I had who have gone on and done things, but I don't particularly want to pick and choose.
Okay.
Among them.
How about a general question then about students in general? And this question is about students' attitude or students' demeanor changing over time.
Yeah, that's a very tough one, because I think the standard answer is to say that their attention span is shorter and that they're not as motivated and the like. And I don't really know whether they're that dramatically different over time. I think you might say, oh, they seem to be less politically involved than in the early 1970s or whatever. That's true. Certainly some of them probably a smaller share are that motivated. I don't know that high level of political involvement was all that constructive. There was a lot of, you know, there was some downside to that as well. I don't know that these kids don't care. I think the thing that I see is, and part of it may be the pressure on them and the like, is that their expectations of doing well are very high. You know, they kind of expect to do well, and I think probably grading has gotten soft. There's no doubt that grading, well, I suppose there is a doubt. If you think the students are that much better, then you say, well, the higher grades just reflect better students. While not saying that the students have gotten worse, I don't think necessarily they've gotten better either. And so I'm inclined to think that grading has become fairly soft. And the grading issue is something that pulls people. There was a man on the faculty, and I won't name him because he was a very good man, and I really liked him, but he was known for being stern, and this was back in the 1970s, early 1980s, who would say, well, you know, a BC for me is a good grade. And what struck me about that is that nobody else but you is going to know that, because when this student applies to the, you know, whatever he or she applies to, and they compare somebody else's easy AB with your very rigorous BC, what it's going to be is a grade point difference, and they're not going to say, oh, X is such a tough grader, he must have done, or she must have done well to do that. So, I mean, to a certain extent, I think what happens is that grades push, there's a push toward conformity in grades. Nobody wants to be, and I don't even know that this is on a conscious level, but I don't think anyone really wants either to be the biggest pushover in the world or to be putting his or her students at a disadvantage because they're the last person on the ramparts holding up standards. So I think that grades have become softer. I think that students tend to expect higher grades. I think probably they do less work for higher grades. So in that sense, over the years, I think that we perhaps don't demand as much as we might have in the past. Yeah. But that just could be an older guy's perception of things, and I could be wrong about that. I don't think they're certainly scared of us. I mean, that's when I was in college, not that you were scared per se, but the faculty member was a much more in an abstract way threatening figure than the faculty member is now. To a certain extent, that probably motivated people to run a little harder. I know I did not enjoy that. I never liked faculty members who started off the course by giving everybody disastrous grades and, you know, ran it kind of like a boot camp where, here's how dumb you are, and I'm going to build you up over the course of the semester, even if it all turned out. It seemed to me to be certain gamesmanship with that. I've never done that myself. And at times, I think that probably made me look as a softer touch. Basically, you know, I would tell them that there would be I'm not going to bury you on the first exam, but there'll be rising expectations for later exams, which I hope there were, but who's to say? Mm-hmm. I think one thing that I find very disappointing about students now, and then this is just, of course, an age thing. You know, this is the barefoot and in the snow, 3 miles to school uphill both ways, is that finding out small pieces of information when I was an undergraduate or a graduate student, for that matter, usually involved a considerable amount of effort. You know, if there was a fact that you were missing, it probably took you half an hour to run down that fact, particularly if you had to go over to the library to check it out, you know, and you had to make priorities as to what's important enough to look up and what can we try to fudge. But now with things like Google and all the search engines, despite any shortcomings those online sources may have, and I think there are some truly misleading online sources, there's also a surprisingly number of good ones, mm-hmm. That students, you know, if they don't have somebody's name or the spelling of the name, they won't bother looking it up. You know, they won't take 10 seconds to Google something on a phone to find out something that's so easily checked. They're indifferent in that regard. And now it may be person now who has seen how much easier it is to get information and now also has the responsibility of having as much information as I can have at my disposal for students, and I'm motivated to do it, and I'm thinking, well, gee, back 30 years ago, 40 years ago, if I were a student and I had these resources to me, I would have been right on top of it. And maybe I wouldn't have. Who knows? Maybe I would be behaving just like them. But it seems to me that students are not taking advantage of the resources. And undoubtedly, some faculty member back in my day was saying, we have this wonderful library across the street and they never go in there or something. It's, you know, it's probably... The truth is probably somewhere in between those, mm-hmm. between those two. But definitely now it is very easy to acquire information that before would have been a real pain in the neck to get. And it's frustrating when if there's a name of, I'd be doing stuff on World War I, for example, and there'd be a name of somebody or there'd be a name of a battle or whatever, and you'd think somebody would just look up, where was that town? Was it in Russia? Was it in Poland? Was it in Germany? I'm looking it up myself to double check. Would it be that hard to do it? Could you not use Google Earth or something and just to help you understand what you're reading? I have this feeling that they read, and if they don't immediately understand what it is, it's not a challenge to find out what it is. It's just, you know, certain things you know, certain things you don't. We'll worry mm-hmm. about that later. If it's important, he'll explain it in class or mm-hmm. or whatever.
And I know you don't want to name names of your students, so again, sort of a more general question about how you would describe yourself as an advisor to the grad students that you had. So sort of overall, how did you work with your grad students?
In some respects, I didn't work with as many graduate students as some other people did. And that was partly probably because of the fields in which I was working, but partly also was almost a conscious choice on my part. I've always been very ambivalent about the graduate program and the extent to which it has difficulty putting people in good jobs. And I'm not eager just to collect PhD students as, you know, kind of trophies that I've turned out this many or whatever, if I felt that I couldn't get them good jobs at the end. And I, you know, for much of my career, the guarantee of doing that has been pretty low. I mean, they're, in general, I did in, let's say, my last 10 to 15 years of teaching, did deal with more graduate students, sort of a kind of regular flow of them. You know, not a tremendous number, maybe 5 or 6 in total over that period, which was pretty modest. I would say I try to be available to them. I gave them their head. If I had a weakness, probably I would assume that things were going all right unless you told me that they weren't. And perhaps at times maybe nipping at their heels a little bit more might have been better. I don't think that was a great problem by anything, but every once in a while you'd find somebody who, you know, they were spinning their wheels a bit, and they probably should have asked for some help before they did, and probably I should have said, well, I haven't heard from this person in X amount of time, maybe they're spinning their wheels. But that, I think, is just kind of the dynamic of how things go. I know that as a graduate student, I like being let alone, and it kind of was the style where I went to school at Columbia. They let you alone. You had some counseling, and then you went off, you did your work, you came back with your work. People sized it up and gave you some advice. And that was kind of the way that I did it. I was very strong with students on writing. Once they handed something in, I hope they had a quick turnaround, but I spent tremendous amounts of time with their organization of material and with their writing. That I sort of made a real big project, trying to teach them as I did it. The extent to which it carried over is hard to say. I know, again, I'm not going to mention names, but I know I have had a couple of students who, in their current positions, have told me that, you know, their coworkers come to them when they want some advice on writing or whatever. So, and they feel that it was of help. I'm not really in a great position to judge that. My students, I mean, I have students who have gotten pretty good academic jobs. I have students who have had a difficult time getting. I've had students who have left academics mostly because this was tended to be toward the end, because they didn't like academics, or they didn't want to teach. They wanted to do some kind of more pure research job. It suited what they wanted to do and their personalities in certain cases, and they've done fine. My last student just got a job after several years, 2 or 3 years of like 1 year positions, finally did get a job, so I'm happy about that. But I don't know that I was particularly different from anyone else. I didn't have people who, outside of the fact that if they worked with me, they were probably interested in, to some extent, in at least the general range of subjects I was interested in. Beyond that, I didn't push them into immediate things. They chose their own topics. They, with my advice, particularly if I thought they were heading off in a route that wasn't. Sometimes they ignored my advice, which they're right to do. Mostly I would say they would work on getting them through preliminary examinations, working on getting their research subject organized. Then they'd go off and do their work, and then they'd start bringing it in. And some of them wanted to bring it all in at once. Some of them wanted to bring in chapter by chapter. I let them do it however they wanted. And once they started bringing stuff in, then the very heavy work of criticism and suggestions started.
Okay. I think I want to talk about, we talked about this, I think, briefly during the first session, but I want to ask it directly. Can you describe your teaching style?
I would say I abhor silences, okay, in classrooms. And so one thing I would say, probably a weakness in my teaching style, particularly in a seminar setting, is that I had to be very careful not to dominate, particularly if I thought that the students weren't getting the points and the conversation was lagging, okay, that I would tend to interject, or direct it probably a bit strongly. That is also reflective of this idea that you have a limited amount of time, you want to get out a lot of information. In my lectures, I think my lectures tended to be heavy on information. They tended to be heavy on information. I don't, I haven't compared myself really with others, but I mean, one reason why I switched, let's say in the past 10 years, from, there's really several stages of the switch, from just doing straight lecturing to using PowerPoints in the lecture, and then for that matter, for teaching online, was that with each step I thought I was getting out more information per hour in a better organized way. That would be it. I wasn't much for rhetorical effects. I would joke a bit. In class I'd joke a bit and show them. For a while there was a time when I kind of enjoyed starting off the lecture by showing them a picture of an exotic animal and asking them what it was or whatever. And particularly if I did it, and I remember showing a picture of my dog one time. It was not quite exotic, but that. And then other kids in the class wanted to say, if I bring in a picture of my dog, will you show it at the beginning of class? So, I was not immune to the human side of it and trying to make human connections with them, but I probably was fairly businesslike in the class and do a fair amount of humor, although my humor tends to be sometimes a little on the dark or ironic side, and I'm not quite sure whether it's always gotten. In terms of both my undergraduate teaching and my graduate teaching, I probably relied much more on article literature than I did on books, especially as time passed. Again, I thought that if I could, if you're reading X number of books, the problem I developed with books was you put so much effort into one item, and it was very hard to say why you had chosen this item rather than any of 10 others. Mm-hmm. All right. And so I decided that I would have them read more things on smaller topics rather than big things on, or I'd have them read smaller things on more topics rather than large things on fewer topics. That's a better way of saying it. It wasn't so much that the topic was more important or less important. It was how you get at it. So it would be more items shorter items on more topics rather than longer items on fewer topics. I think that partly had to do with the fact that I was oriented toward the social sciences and a lot of the literature, particularly in immigration and the like, does appear in that. Part of it is the difficulty of getting chapters out of books in a convenient and legal way. I mean, there's usually you can link to an article on an online source and everything is legit, whereas if you're photocopying a chapter out of somebody's book and making it available, it gets a little bit more iffy that way. So I tended to avoid that. I think it also had to do, to a certain extent, with my graduate school education. And this was something I noticed when I came here, the difference. Like at Columbia, when I was going through, the idea was really never to read a full book if you could avoid it. It was to get the essence of it, to know what it was about, to know what the principal arguments was. But it was much more important to read more things in part rather than fewer things in full. And when I got here, I got the impression that fewer things in full was the way that most people were oriented. And I never... I made the effort to adapt to that, but I never really fully succeeded. Probably didn't want to.
You talked about PowerPoint, so my other question about teaching style, and you alluded to it, is sort of the rise in technology and how, if it changed your teaching style. I was wondering if you talk about that a bit
more. It did and it didn't, in the sense that I was always interested in a kind of visual aid, let's say graphs and things of that nature. And whatever the technology of the time was, I attempted to use it, whether you're mimeographing something or had one of those transparencies that you put down on a light and projected it. What I found was that when, certainly after things like PowerPoint became available, then it became much easier to do that smoothly without having to go over to the machine and put something down on it and take something out and the like. In some ways, it was a progression. It was something that I wanted to do all the time and attempted to do all the time, but was able to do to a greater extent as the technology became available to do it. I think probably just about everybody uses some kind of presentation like this. I think I probably was one of the first in the department to do it in a serious way. And indeed, in terms of online teaching, still relatively few do it. And I certainly was one of the first to do it.
So what course were you teaching online?
The primary one that I did online was the immigration course.
And
it was kind of a hybrid thing, because I would also meet with sections and stuff like that. So the lecture part went online, and then there were also meetings with the TA, meetings with me and stuff like that to do it. So usually it was not a fully online course. Usually it was some kind of hybrid course. Although once in a summer I taught it as a wholly online course, and I didn't really see much difference in the outcome.
What, if anything, and maybe you haven't even thought about this, but the rise in email as a way, how that related or didn't relate to students actually coming in and seeing you?
Well, the thing that strikes me is, I would say, now, I have to be careful here, because this could just be part of the process of aging and the changing of cohorts in the department and the like. But when I got here in the 70s, I would say people seemed to be much more office oriented and in the hallways and lunching together, and students seem to be crowding in the hallways looking to see people or to ask questions or whatever the case might be. And that over time, you know, there are days when I think you could fire a cannon down this hallway and hit nothing except maybe a student who was looking for Vilas Hall and was in here accidentally. I think to a certain extent, computers and email and the like has privatized, I don't know if that's the right word or not, but it certainly has made the pursuit of work and interactions with students a more solitary kind of activity, that there's less importance in being physically available when you are constantly available online. I think in some ways it's bad in terms of sort of the interactions of the department, people with one another. But that's where I qualified. It could simply be that my generation has come and gone, and that, you know, the younger cohort of people who are in here now, that we've, you know, done a tremendous amount of hiring in the last 10 years, but the younger cohort of people who are in here now have their social networks and the likes of which I'm not particularly aware anymore, although I don't know that they exist in the hallways as much. You don't see people clustered outside of somebody's door in the way you did, swapping stories in the afternoon or discussing office politics or how to approach some managerial problem for the department. Maybe they do it, you know, in social gatherings or something, but it seems less oriented around the building than it did before.
Maybe one more thing for this time. There's a few more things I want to ask, but I want to try to cram them in.
Yeah, okay.
So I'd like to ask about, and it, I think it, it's apropos to talking about sort of the lack of interaction, and that's the idea of campus and near-campus spaces. So when you got here, where did you do your work? Where did you interact with other faculty?
For the most part, here in this building, and particularly when I was an assistant professor, and even after that, there was a very vibrant department culture. I mean, people would have, not the same people every day, but people would have brown bag lunch together every day. And you got to know people that way and the like. I wouldn't say everyone did it or the same people did it every day. But, you know, there was a fairly constant cast of characters with some rotators who made, like, comets make periodic appearances. That was the way. I have a feeling, in a way, that the geography is destiny academically. And, no, I mean, it was contrary to my interests, but I think having us in history down here with the artists and the musicians didn't do a heck of a lot for me, I admit. Now, the rationale for that, I am sure, is that we're right across the street from Memorial Library and from the Historical Society. It's a great location. If you see yourself every afternoon as leaving your office and going to the library, and I think that's probably part of why it was doing. In terms of intellectual stimulation, I found some of the best times that I had in a period when I, about 3 years or so in the 80s, when I worked up in the social science building with the economists and the sociologists and that group. When I was getting more interested in computers, and there was just a different environment there because they had a working email at a time that we didn't. They, you know, the topics that I was interested in were much more likely to be discussed in people coming through that building than they were coming through this building. You know, so I've always had that kind of feeling that to a certain extent, geography is destiny in an academic environment. What would the history department be like if it were grouped with sociology and economics instead of with art and music? I mean, I don't think it has very much interaction with art and music at all. I mean, a few people probably do. I know that, for example, John Barker, who was a sort of an early modern period person, Byzantine history and the like, tremendous interest in music, and that may have done that. I know other people have interests in art and the like, but I'd say for the most part, there's not. I think in some ways being in the same building with the English department for a portion of the department might have been more interesting than being here. But again, that was it. For me, initially, the environment was here, but it was the history department. And as time expanded, I became a little bit more oriented toward the social science building, especially in the 80s. I was working a fair amount up there because they gave me some minor administrative responsibility for a data library up there. And I, you know, so I used that as an excuse to spend more time up there. Mm-hmm. And then in the 90s, I came back down here more, partly because that had expired, partly because we did finally get email and things of that nature down here. Then I was taking on some other departmental responsibilities, and including being chair in the late 90s. So you know, that tied me pretty well.
So the last thing then would be, at least I want to give you space at the end, but yeah. My last question is, so you talked about academic spaces. What about spaces on or near campus for socializing, like, you know, having a beer or something?
Oh, yeah, there are, I mean, groups of guys would, or not guys just simply, but in the old days it would have been, but, you know, mixed groups now would go over to places like the Big Ten Pub on Regent Street, or some of the places that used to be down on Brothers, that used to be down at, what is it, University in Francis, I guess it was, and or go over to the Memorial Union, things that, those things. It varied. At times I would do that fairly regularly, other times I wouldn't do it at all. I don't think I was super into that kind of activity. Somewhat, but not a great deal.
Tom, is there anything on your mind?
Yeah, I think for next time, if you wanted, you're asking me the impact that my military experience had on me, and I think in terms of the teaching that I did, for example, when I would teach, let's say, an American history survey, the fact that I would cover the military side of it, or that in recent years I've given sort of long-running, well, one was maybe ran about 10 years, a seminar on the Korean War, and then for 3 or 4 years, one on World War One. I guess it was 3 years probably I did that. I think that was undoubtedly tied. I mean, it was a combination of things, but it was there was some interest there, and there were kinds of courses that people wanted taught, and there were anniversaries of particular events coming up, and the like. That probably as much as anything would, insofar as you're after this theme of the my military experience and how it affected my performance here, that might be something we could spend a little bit of time on.
Great. We will do that next time then. So this concludes the third interview with Thomas Archdeacon. Tom, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Okay.